was in a different room or?
Oh, okay, fine.
Just checking. Because I had two links, I thought, anyway, it's all good. And then Zoom started updating, of course, last minute. No podcast or anything like that. So it's kind of fun. And I like the cat walking around there.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It adds the gothic element. So.
Okay, good. Yeah.
I have a dog, but I went to my office, so it'll be okay.
It really is. Hey, listener, this is Sam, and I'm here with Eliza. We just had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Valeria Sobol.
Dr. Valeria Sobol is an associate professor of Slavic languages and literatures at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's the author of two books, Febris Erotica, Love Sickness in the Russian Literary Imagination, and her more recent book, Haunted Empire, Gothic and the Russian Imperial Uncanny. Hope you enjoy.
You're listening to The Slavic Connection, brought to you by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies and the William P. Clinton Center for National Security at the University of Texas at Austin.
Should we get started?
Great. Beautiful. All right. So I think the first question that we wanted to start with, just like super basic, was, I mean, what's the story behind this book? Like what inspired you to write this book? How did you get here?
Thanks. Yeah. The story is kind of long, but hopefully vaguely interesting. So it's very different from my first book, which was based on my dissertation, which was on a kind of sexy but unrelated topic of lovesickness in Russian literature in connection. Well, it has Febris Erotica in the title, the diagnosis, kind of Latin diagnosis for lovesickness. So it was more about literature and medicine, interactions between those two fields, and how this trope of lovesickness was its idea that somehow an emotional distress, unrequited love, right, destroys the human body. So I was curious to see what's behind that assumption, besides it being kind of an interesting literary technique, right, or formula, what actual philosophical medical theories behind, you know, about the interaction of the emotional and the physical, right, the mind and body, what current debates were unfolding. So that was quite a different story. And that was my first dissertation, the first book. But I had also kind of been intrigued by how ethnicities are portrayed in literature or even in travel literature and ethnographic materials that might have to do with my own background as a Soviet Ukrainian Jew, you know, being sort of a bit of the other in my environment in the former Soviet Union. And I taught a course on travel literature and started seeing even some of the same works I used to teach in different courses as just surveys and so on. I started seeing some really interesting things happening when locals are portrayed, right, or ethnic minorities. I also started noticing the kind of the elements of uncertainty, fear, dark kind of atmosphere surrounding those encounters. And that kind of led me to an idea to explore kind of possible Gothic implications of this imperial context in which many of the Russian works are set. But also being from Ukraine, I kind of wanted in my second project to include some Ukrainian material. This is also kind of an interesting area of the empire, often portrayed in Russian literature, often portrayed by even Ukrainian writers who kind of wrote in Russian as a sort of this ambivalent place, which is so familiar and almost the same as us, but at the same time still exotic and can be kind of demonic. So yeah, that was kind of all these different personal, professional, just intellectual curiosity that brought me to the book. But I think the trigger was actually teaching the travel course and focusing on one novella from Lermontov's novel, A Hero of Our Time, which is well known in Russia, well known in the West by those who study it, who take him in any Russian literature survey. It's set mostly in the Caucasus, but there is this novella, Taman, in the middle, which described the hero's travel to the Caucasus. And he stays in this, and I open my book with this example, on the way to the Caucasus, this Russian disillusioned, right, Byronic officer stays in this small town, frontier town, in the south, which is still Russia, which he unambiguously refers to as this like little godforsaken ugly town in Russia. But he encounters locals who speak Ukrainian to him, but Russian among themselves, who may be blind or maybe not, maybe deaf or maybe not. And he's completely disoriented in that strange space. And actually, the more dangerous things happened to him there was he's still in Russia and not so much in the Caucasus. At least I argue that's the case. And that was really the trigger that kind of led to the to exploring this issue of the Gothic imperial encounters in the larger scale. Sorry for the long answer.
Yeah, no, the long answer is great. It's wonderful. Yeah, I think that does a really good job of explaining and talking about how this idea of the imperial comes to it, because that's definitely not something that, you know, when I think of the word Gothic, that's not, you know, the word that I would immediately append to it. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit just about kind of broadly, like what characterizes the Gothic genre?
Yeah. So obviously there's tons, lots of scholarly literature written on the Gothic, especially English Gothic, which is sort of was the cradle of Gothic literature. And there are different theories, but basically, and it's sort of separately, even from the imperial context, there's a sort of a set of characteristics. It's a very formulaic genre, right? There's recognizable tropes. There were even parodies in late 18th and early 19th century about a recipe, how to write a Gothic novel, like what ingredients to mix in to get one. So people were very aware of their of the formulaic, right, kind of stable nature of the genre. So the recipes mentioned, like throw some owls and some bandits and a cave, you know, and dark atmosphere and spook everybody, and then you have a good Gothic novel. And there is some truth to it. So seriously, it has to be about fear. It has to be about anxiety. It often has very specific setting, a castle. Well, the word Gothic, right? It's an original architectural term, right? But in literature, in connection to the genre, it's simply meant medieval. And medieval wasn't just simply medieval. It wasn't just a historic designation. It was supposed to invoke all these associations with barbarism, darkness, superstition, irrationality. And the genre being developed in late 18th century in England, which saw itself as enlightened, Protestant, right, Northern, it kind of, as some scholars argued, and I agree, displaced this kind of realm of this of the irrational, of backwards, of subconscious, right, into that Southern Catholic settings with their Gothic castles and monks, right, and some, you know, stories on transgression. So the setting is often predictable. It's a castle. It could be a cemetery, an abbey, right? At least partly, which is not always the case for Russia, which didn't have many castles, obviously, because of its own history. So we can talk about it later. But speaking about kind of a classical Gothic novel, so there is the atmosphere of fear and anxiety. There's a predictable specific setting. There's a theme of transgression often. It could be incest. It could be some crime in the past that, but it always has to be some kind of destabilization of some boundaries, right? The element of the supernatural can be part of it, crossing boundaries, right, between real and unreal, but it's not required. But there's almost always some kind of hint of the supernatural. It can be unveiled as just, you know, some relative walking or, you know, the mad woman in the attic, right? Not necessarily a ghost, but in some cases, we have a real devil, right? Very, very present. So the supernatural element is not required, but often suggested and sometimes just dismissed at the end or finds a rational explanation. There are often some stock characters, like a villain with burning eyes, a male figure usually, who tortures a young innocent maiden who somehow is like whose fate is at his disposal, some poor ward or orphan and so on. Yeah, I think these are the main characteristics. But what actually I do in the book, it's not a study of the genre, right? And I kind of make it clear in the introduction that I talk about the Gothic mode rather than the Gothic novel, because the Gothic novel really developed in British literature in the second half of the 18th century and flourished in the 1790s, early 1800s, up to 1820s. And many scholars actually see the peak of the genre associated with the French Revolution, the aftermath of the French Revolution that sends, even though the theme itself is not there. It's often, the novel's often set in a completely different time period, but that sense of disorientation, kind of the fear, anxiety about the world order crumbling, and also the kind of crisis of reason, enlightenment, right, ideals brought back this kind of themes of fear, the supernatural, the irrational anxiety that Gothic novels so readily provide. But the classical novel itself kind of wanes, Gothic novel. And in Russia, it never really existed in the kind of full-fledged form, novellas perhaps, or historical novels with the elements of the Gothic. But I think Gothic mode is a nice compromise because it doesn't have to be a Gothic novel with a castle to to kind of activate all these themes, right, and motifs. So as long as you have some elements that I described that are tightly connected to the themes of, again, past haunting the present, some sense of transgression, disorientation, the irrational that's kind of breaks through the veneer, or the barbarity that breaks through the veneer of civilization, or the triumph of reason, then I think it's okay. We can talk about the Gothic presence, even if you don't have a castle, or you have a little hut instead of a castle. Or even if you have a parody of the Gothic genre that sometimes, you know, people say, okay, this is just funny and nothing, there's nothing beyond that. It's just a parody is a fashionable literary form. But I kind of tend to take Gothic elements seriously. And specifically, I think what my main contribution is that I look very closely at this, that's where the imperial comes into play, at this setting of the works, because it's very common in scholarship, or it was at least, to dismiss the historical and geographical context, because the idea was that Gothic novels are either just for entertainment and sensationalism, or more seriously, they're about some metaphorization of the inner split, or psychological trauma, or the subconscious, right, the suppressed emotions and fears. So the setting is just conventional, you know, it just has to be exotic to attract the reader. The historical setting is vague. It's supposed to be some vague Middle Ages or some vague past. But some scholars, and I joined their ranks, started working against this idea, and I found it extremely productive. Once you started looking at actually where this, especially in the Russian imperial context and historical context, where these works are set, and what the historical events used for the plot, suddenly you start seeing that they're not just, you know, paraphernalia, they're not just some kind of, you know, ornaments, there's serious historical concerns and imperial concerns that underlie these seemingly formulaic, entertaining genre cliches. So,
wow, that's so cool. Just a tiny follow-up question. One thing that you touch on the topic of Gothic modes that comes up in the book is this concept of the Scottian mode versus the supernatural mode. And I was wondering if you could just, I mean, as briefly or as in-depth as you'd like, tell us about the different modes.
Yeah, so the thing is, yeah, sort of in Russia, things happen with a delay, you know, like literary developments. And this is one of the reasons why Gothic literature was understudied or, you know, not given full attention in Russian and Slavic studies, at least Russian Ukrainian, because it was seen as just another dominant literary form that comes to the Russian Empire later. And, you know, just imitation, the desire to be, you know, in step with the Western developments. And there's nothing more to that. And like, no. We have to really zoom in and see what's going on there. Yeah. So, and the historical novel, on the other hand, was greeted as this kind of, you know, the genre that really is. So while the Gothic novel was dismissed as historically vague and geographically irrelevant, historical novel is all about research, ethnographic, right, elements, this interest in history, imaginative reconstruction of history. Of course, then you have castles also in historical novels, and whether the Gothic or not, right, you can argue. But I think it's the juxtaposition of the popularity of Walter Scottian historical novel and the Gothic genre that produced some interesting hybrids sort of in the Russian case and the Ukrainian case, specifically because actually my last chapter deals with the Ukrainian Walter Scott figure, Pantelimon Kulish. He was literally labeled this way by his friends and contemporaries. And there were a lot of discussion at the time comparing Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia to Scotland vis-a-vis England as also kind of neighboring territories, related but distinct, right, with its exotic folklore and the rebellious tradition, right, and so on. And even Russian journals were writing like, we need a Ukrainian Walter Scott, we need somebody like that. But this sort of binary opposition is, you know, that pits the two genres or modes against each other is not productive. There's a lot of overlap. And, you know, some people say sometimes a castle is just a castle. Yes. But I see in most, even like historically oriented novels, the castle is often saturated with history, with past transgression. It doesn't have to be even family transgression. It can be, or even the family transgression often bears some national trauma. In this as well. In the case of Kulish, it was the loss of Ukraine by its autonomy, because his novel, like Waverly by Scott, you know, is set a few decades in the past before. In the case of Scott, is before the suppression of the Jacobite uprising and kind of spread of English, political and cultural influence, and also loss of the authentic culture. And Kulish is doing something very similar, describing Ukraine, already part of Russia, but before its political and cultural structure was completely assimilated. And before the, before Catherine the Great's reign, I should say Catherine the Second, because I was warned many times she wasn't so great for Ukraine. So I should probably stick to a more neutral definition. So before the raising of the Zaporizhian Cossack siege, right? And other development. So it's kind of nostalgic invocation of that authentic, still autonomous culture. But Kulish is much more ambiguous, I think, than Scott. He both accepts the empire, Russian, like incorporation to the Russian empire as an inevitable sort of solution for Ukraine to join modernity. And on the other hand, he is painfully split about that loss of authenticity as a romantic nationalist. So it's really interesting. And I think, again, these historical settings are full of those Gothic ghosts of the past, right? That lost culture, that lost identity, that haunts the present. And if you see the results, I mean, these phantoms are still well alive in our time, unfortunately, so.
The lost culture and the lost identity being, these locuses of trauma. Going back to the idea of like the Gothic mode, just kind of a supplementary question, I guess, is you mentioned early in the book this distinction between the Gothic novel and then novels that use Gothic tropes and ideas. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that distinction and that difference.
Yeah, thanks. My this whole thing about the Gothic mode versus the Gothic genre, right, as I said. So some scholars say you have to be very strict. There's a whole set of characteristics you have to check the work against to prove and be confident that it's really a Gothic novel. Or again, like with the castle, right? Sometimes a castle is a castle and just a setting and there's nothing Gothic about it. It has to be metaphorically dense and like carry this additional symbolic meaning to count as a Gothic trope. And I think that you don't have to be that. You can be more flexible, right? One Gothic trope or two can really invoke the whole. It's such a well-developed, stable tradition that a couple of tropes can invoke, again, incest or, the dark house, the forbidden room, the forbidden chamber is another common trope, right? Some dark room you're not supposed to go into, right? That can invoke the whole tradition, basically, the whole genre tradition. And almost always it carries. It's rarely just a setting. It can be. But whenever, as I said, there is this past trauma or past transgression or some, criminal, some past crime, or again, the national trauma associated with this place, like again, Kulish, right? There's a house there that the hero lives in, and then he leaves it to embark on his kind of Walter Scottian chivalric pursuit of glory in the Russian Imperial Army, which is a bit of already a problem. But we learn from the novel that his house, the father built the house, having found the plan of Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the headman of Ukraine, that reproduces exactly the house of that headman that was destroyed in a different Ukrainian town. So that house is not just a house, it's not just a family history, it's a basically represent the history of Ukraine, right? And it's more independent incarnation. And the hero, burns the house accidentally on the way out. He leaves some candle or something. And there is a huge curse then that follows that act. And his father is already unhappy that he's leaving, not just that he's leaving the nest, but he's joining the Imperial Army in the vain hope, according to the father, of kind of recreating this heroic ethos of the Cossacks of the past. His father knows it's not the right time, it's not the right place, it's gone. His father is kind of this actual Walter Scottian antiquarian figure who like does ethnographic work. He thinks that's the right venue now for maintaining Ukrainian culture, not some kind of not mythological, but romantic, a heroic fight. So it's so interesting, right? There's so many layers of there, but then the house is burned and the curse follows. And that's kind of the source of all the Gothic horrors that follows and misfortunes in the story. So in the sense, it is a Walter Scottian novel, but it's a very significant Gothic twist. There's also a demonic Jewish character in the novel. And there are some Orientalized Serbs that appear in the middle of Ukraine in a cave. Very interesting. But yeah, and then the house becomes a ruin. And the ruin is one of another Gothic trope, but it's not just a physical remnant of a building, right? That kind of symbolic fragment of some totality, right? Of some, again, authenticity, of some culture of the past that's both gone, but also it's here because we have this ruin, right? So that's why I'm saying, right? We can look at it as just a setting, as a building being destroyed, or you can look at it as a powerful symbol that invokes all this, you know, historical national themes through the Gothic trope of a ruin or a castle, even though it's not technically a castle, but it has Gothic elements, those architectural even. There's a Gothic gate there that the writers make sure to throw in to invoke the tradition. So I think it's not so clear cut, and it's more productive to look beyond the setting. I hope it made sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. So in your book, there's two key areas, two imperial borderlands that you focus on, right? There's the north, there's Finland and Sweden, with Sweden portrayed as a kind of even greater other. And then there's the south, there's Ukraine, the Caucasus. So I'd love to hear, I mean, we read your amazing book, of course, but for the readers who probably have not yet, what identifies the North and South as key poles, key areas in this Russian imperial Gothic?
Thanks so much. Great question. I'm glad you asked it. So originally I took this North-South axis from the studies of the British Gothic, because exactly as I mentioned, well, the term Gothic itself comes from the Goths, right? Who was at the time Germanic tribe sacked Rome, right? It was already north-south opposition, right? The northern barbarous, supposedly barbarous wild tribe attacks the, you know, ancient developed southern civilization. But then when the term develops as an architectural term in the Renaissance era, later this term is applied to architecture because of its whimsical elements and seen as kind of disturbing, tasteless, too ornate, not in line with, you know, the classical harmonious criteria of classical antiquity. So it still carries negative connotation. But then, that's what I meant, in the late 18th century, when the genre develops in England, the geographical and symbolic poles are switched. So what we have, Enlightenment now, right? We have northern Protestant countries, England seeing itself among them, kind of displacing, as I said, right, portraying all the horrors of, you know, again, all this transgression, irrational fear, superstition as kind of characteristic of the Catholic South. So basically what was the past for all of Europe, right? And now they see it as successful overcome. They displace geographically to Southern Europe because Catholicism was obviously associated with like dark Middle Ages, barbarism, right? And all this mysticism and irrationality and so on. So, okay, that's all good. But then you have Russia, the Russian Empire, and this definition is not relevant, right? We don't have this Protestant-Catholic really tension. But I was still curious to explore the North-South axis. Part of it was just playing the devil's advocate. I got so tired of this East-West paradigm, like Russia between East and West, Orientalism, and I love it and I teach it. But, you know, I was like, let's look at North-South. It's not paid enough attention. And actually, it's very, I didn't just bring it in from the English, you know, studies of English literature. It's there. If you look at late 18th, early 19th century works, Karamzin's, for example, first Russian historian, but also writer, his Letters of Russian Traveler, when he and his narrator travel to the West, he always positions himself as a northerner. So like, he's hanging out with Danes and Swedes and English, and like, we poor North, nobody's talking about Russia. So he clearly positions Russia as part of this kind of northern community. So I was thinking like, yeah, this North-South Gothic position inherent in the Gothic genre in England, how would it play out in the Russian context? And then, of course, there was imperial expansion both into the North as a result of the wars with Sweden and the South, the Crimea, right? Some Ukrainian territories, and then the war in the Caucasus in the 19th century. So I started looking at that. And what attracted me specifically to Finnish Baltic territories on the one hand, and Ukraine actually rather than the Caucasus, because the Caucasus is the clear southern other. It's exotic, it's religiously different, ethnically different. There is a bloody colonial war going on. and it's been studied more. And maybe I'm biased because I was from Ukraine and I wanted to bring Ukraine more into the picture. But Ukraine also was consistently referred to throughout the 19th century, or at least big chunk of it, as Southern Russia. It was seen as the kind of southern variant of Great Russia, right? Or the Southern Double, as they call it, because, you know, it's more Gothic this way, uncanny. But what is interesting about those regions is that they are sort of others, but other, but also part of Russia's narratives of origins, because you have, of course, the Varangian invitation, right? Narratives, it's maybe not as known, but in the, you know, medieval chronicle, right, of sort of history of East Slavic lands, there is a famous story about the leaders of the northern sort of territories, like that had a mixed Slavic and Finno-Ugric population, that they cannot create order there. It's a mess. And they invite Vikings, right? Varangian princes to rule over them. So there is this kind of sense that Russia, contemporary Russia in the 19th century, right, can trace its origin to that northern ruling dynasty. And even the territories, right, in the north around Finland and the Baltics have this kind of mixed population. And the writers make use of it, kind of claiming, artistically claiming, those territories on the basis of that in their works. And then Kyiv, of course, right, is still seen, well, as a kind of, maybe we should get into the contemporary situation because the book suddenly has larger relevance than I ever expected. But the idea that Kyiv is the cradle, right, of Orthodox Christianity, the mother of Russian towns that's or cities that's often translated as Russian cities. So it's also the story of the origin of that kind of Muscovite state, and now, you know, the Russian state has kind of incorporated into its history, right? That's where our Christianity started, our connection to Byzantium, right? And to the whole Western and Southern European legacy. So, and that's kind of what makes those regions uncanny, which is another very important part of my project. It's not just exotic, it's not just Gothic, it's not just scary, it's uncanny. I can explain the term in a minute if you want me to. But this interplay between the familiar and unfamiliar, these regions that are, on the one hand, are new, they were annexed to the Russian territory relatively recently by the time those writers were creating their works, right? Finland, slowly over the case of 18th and 19th century, as a result of wars with Sweden, right? Baltic, the same, early 19th century, and Ukraine gradually, which was part of the, big part of it was part of the Commonwealth, right? Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth that was, starting with the 17th century and on, but it still was perceived as something unique and different, but at the same time, it's us. but in the purer form, sometimes they use the language of like almost, from our perspective, almost racial purity. Like this is the pure Slavdom, it's pure incarnation. We lost it as a result of Westernization, but Ukrainians still have that authentic culture. So it's really weird mix of that claim of oneness and being the same and being us and the recognition of its foreign, exotic, desirable, or also threatening status. And I think that creates that unsettling effect that is inherent in the concept of uncanny that underlies so many, this can be found in so many works I look at. And that's why I focused on these territories, actually. So unexpectedly, this north-south axis turned out to be perhaps even more interesting in the Russian imperial context than I had expected. So.
And the notion of uncanny that you use in your book, I mean, I think probably we all understand that, like, the strict definition, but I think it actually talking about the definition in the context of the topic of your book is like so interesting, right? Because it's not the great other. It's not the absolute other. It's this small, like just a little shift of alterity that makes it uncanny specifically, right? Just enough to look at it and go, well, that's less familiar than it should be. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of can be more disturbing, right? Because it's the clear other, you know, is something completely different. You have to run away, right? Or like if it's a monster, right? But if it's a human with monstrous characteristics or the strange, confusing, you know, language or qualities, then you don't quite know what to do and you're more unsettled. Exactly. So I borrowed the term from Freud, actually, even though my work is not psychoanalytical analysis, but this concept, it's been used in postcolonial studies, colonial studies before, but I found it also very productive. So he has this famous essay. Okay, my German is very limited, but I can pronounce Das Unheimliche in 1919. It's really an amazing essay because even for those who might be not into psychoanalysis of Freud, it actually has strong, you're a linguistics major, right? Linguistics component, because a big part of the first part of the essay dedicated to the etymology of the term in German. And in the core of the term is home, unheimlich, right? Unhomely. But Freud shows through the etymological analysis that the unhomely, unheimlich, as opposed to heimlich, homely, cozy, familiar, they actually share some of the etymology because heimlich, the good one, the homey, the familiar, also develops a meaning of something concealed, something only for those at home, something for the insiders. And as a result, it turns into the meaning of unfamiliar, strange for others, right? It's but also esoteric, unsettling, threatening. So in that level, exactly, the opposition between what's homey, what's and what's other, what's self, what's other, what's foreign, right, what's not, the opposition really blurs. And Freud, of course, connects it to psychoanalytical level, the return of the repressed, in the sense that it's something familiar, but not familiar because you repressed it, right? But I was interested in this effect concept in the context of the like national and political anxieties. So the idea that the foreign, the disturbing, right, the other resides in the familiar and homey really, I think, applies well to the Russian imperial context, precisely for the reasons we've discussed, right? You expand into territories that you think your own, but also see them as new and different. There's also, well, that's something that historians have written about a lot about the lack of overseas colonies, right? The fact that you keep expanding into contiguous territory with people often racially similar or even linguistically, like Ukrainians, right? And Belarusians makes the whole distinction between the colonizer and the colonized more blurred, right? You often colonize the population that's more educated than the majority of your population. There are many comments on the literacy and high level of, yeah, like language proficiency by Finnish peasants, by the travelers to Finland, while the Russian peasantry was notoriously illiterate by and large. But then you have to make a civilizational claim, right? For the empire to advance and to colonize, you have to bring this light of enlightenment, right? That's the main justification. So how do you do this? That's when Gothic tropes come handy, because if you portrayed Finland not as a, you know, former part of Sweden with all the benefits of Western civilization, right? But as a dark, and it was kind of mythologist, dark, ahistorical people living among gloomy cliffs, separated from the course of history, wizards, right? Capable to talk to nature and to invoke some spirits and so on. Then, yeah, they need to enter history through the Russian intervention, right? So in that sense, yeah, this is a very important category for me and the uncanny, but specifically as the imperial uncanny. But at the same time, you do, like with Pechorin, the Lermontov hero from Lermontov's novel, right, in the small town. I love this example. It's a perfect example of the imperial uncanny, because he's an imperial officer. He's traveling with official documentation. He's going to join the Russian army in the south fighting imperial as part of this colonial project in the Caucasus. And he's stuck in this real Russian town, which is full of Ukrainians. It's former Cossack settlement, actually. And I checked the census from 1895, which is much later, but it's the first sentence. And the Ukrainian language is listed as the primary language of the region. And he cannot even put a finger anthropologically on those people. Are they related as a family? Are they kin? Are they deaf? Are they blind? You know, from linguistic and religious and kin ties to their even physical disabilities, right? Everything is unstable. Everything is called into question. So where is this? Where am I, right? You can say, am I still in Russia? Am I not? I'm in this dark, disturbing territory, right? That's sort of still Russia, but not anymore. And I'm completely helpless there. I can get out of there. There's no boat, right? He can get out and his possessions are stolen. He's almost drowned. So things that happened to him there are actually more dangerous and destructive than whatever he experiences in the Caucasus later, where there's an actual exotic enemy, exactly that, non-uncanny, just the other. And so I look from this sort of idea of home and the uncanny home, I metaphorically read the empire as this kind of problematic home for its subjects. The home where it want to be at home, but it's never quite the comforting, especially once you reach the borderlands, exactly for the reasons I've described.
One of the things that I was really struck by in the book is when you bring up this idea of like mimicry in colonial discourse and how in the British Empire, the goal was not full mimicry of the colonial subject, because then that would, you know, diminish the so-called superiority, right, of the British. But then in Russia, that the goal is complete mimicry and Russification. So I was fascinated by that. And it felt very, very relevant. And I was curious, since this came out in 2020, before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, is there anything that like you would change or write differently or add to it, you know, if you were writing it today instead?
Thank you. That's a great question. Absolutely. Actually, yeah, if you looked at my conclusion, okay, first a confession in order. I used to be very uncomfortable bringing politics into my research. I work in the 19th century. My first, as you know, project was on literature and science. So it has some political implications for the time, but nothing contemporary relevance. And when I conceived of this project back in 2012, I was in Kyiv on sabbatical and thought like, yeah, I'm drawn to this. I really want to write about the empire in the 19th century. It has no contemporary relevance or very limited. So it's just going to be a historical literary project. And then as I work on it, right, the Maidan revolution happens and the annexation of Crimea, right, and the Donbass war. And I decided, like, I'm going to talk about it openly. There is no way I cannot not mention, I cannot avoid it. And I put it in the conclusion that, because I really saw it as this something uncanny and horrible. It was a nightmare come true that was happening. And even before the full-scale invasion, exactly. And so I wrote about the return. It's not just the fact of the military conflict, but the rhetoric that came with this, right? Exactly things I saw in my literary text, even by progressive Russian writers like the Decembrists, who wrote about the Baltics and still made colonial, sort of implicit colonial claims to the territory. How is it different from Putin, who said, right, I compared himself to Peter the Great and said, we're just returning those territories, Finland, right? And well, Petersburg was built on the Finnish swamps, right, as writers would say, as the war with Sweden was still going. So this exact uncanny expansion, right, is happening. This is a other territory that becomes the center of very origin of Russia's own Western kind of new empire. Yeah, so I put a lot of this, and also the discourse about, especially the Maidan, as like Ukraine is a reign of dark chaos, right, that needs to be brought to order, that's such a mess, right, that because it didn't follow the, you know, the Russian path. It's very similar to how Cossackdom was perceived in or like in romantic novels, as it's portrayed by Russian critics in the 19th century. And the fears in the Baltic countries, right, about possible Russian intrusion also kind of made the northern part of my book relevant. So now, and I sent my manuscript in 2019 and thinking, oh, this is going to be so dated in a couple of years when I'm writing about, you know, because things kind of, the conflict had frozen at the time. And then 22 comes and it's just absolutely horrible. So I don't know, I probably wouldn't have, one thing I would have changed, I used Kyiv in the Ukrainian transliteration throughout the book, but Kyiv and Rus and some other like more acceptable in the West, Russified transliteration. So maybe I would have completely gone Ukraine, like with the Ukrainianized transliteration, but this is a semi-technical thing. I think conceptually, I couldn't add anything because, except for, you know, making direct reference to the events, because I think it speaks for itself. I'm not very happy I wrote this book, to be honest. I feel like I did some, it's not just for my own academic development, but I did something important for the critique of Russian imperialism that turned out to be, I would think, such an old topic, right? In the Western context, empire studies, you know, is already not cool, right? A passé, but unfortunately, Russia keeps it all relevant. So yeah, no, nothing conceptual. I think what I saw there actually was there and is still alive today. This imperial uncanny, the inability to recognize the otherness of its neighbors, right? The desire to make it your own home. Yeah, unfortunately, still with us. Yeah.
Wow, while we're talking about Ukraine specifically, really, I really appreciated the Ukrainian section of the book. I thought it was so interesting, especially how you identify this kind of complex relationship that we can sometimes see coming out, Ukrainian writers negotiating their relationship with empire and with contributing to this kind of imperial canon, you know, which has to be approved by the right people, as it were. That was really, really interesting to me. I'd love to hear more, you know, talk about that complex relationship and how we see it come through. And something else that I think noticed that I really loved was just like glints of humor in some of these Ukrainian novels that you discussed that were just so funny to me. Okay. Like, I think Kulish, he has a character named Pan Bardak, right? So funny. And then in Pokorelsky's The Convent Graduate, right, where the guy's trying to negotiate and the innkeeper is just like pretends to be deaf.
Yeah, which actually I think then later maybe, I mean, this novel was very popular. And I don't know if Lermontov read it, but this deaf and, you know, pretending possibly to be deaf and blind in Tamine might be a continuation of this tradition. But there's something about this colonial encounters, right? If you have the representative of the authority imposing this authority to you, might as well go deaf, right?
Yeah, and another funny,
oh, and a lot in Pogorelsky, in The Common Graduate, the note about the teeth of the heroine who's trying to, because she was imitating so readily like French culture, but in Ukrainian provinces, she couldn't find those fancy French dentists, so her teeth were just made out of wax. And it's such, on the one hand, it's a joke. On the other hand, it's such a powerful metaphor of the cultural dependence, right? That just like she's trying to overcome her Ukrainian provinciality by imitating the what she perceives as the Russian capital's, you know, refined galomania. But actually, where does it stop, right? Everybody mimicry, right? That's really, everybody imitates somebody else. And there's this kind of the gothic spooky emptiness behind it. So I think even the humorous moments have still those serious concerns. And that's why Monasterka, the Convent Graduate, actually, because it's seen as a parody, justly as a gothic novel, was often read just like that. Entertaining, popular, fun little novel. And there's a wonderful Russian scholar, Vadim Vatsuro, who has an interesting chapter who like disentangles all the connections to various Gothic texts and formulas in it. But he completely reads it as a kind of Russian novel about the provinces. While I start looking at the Ukrainian context, right? Pogorelsky himself as a grandson of the last hetman of Ukraine and the heroine who was coming from this Cossack, right, clan and was sent to St. Petersburg to study in the whole territory. And I think there's, again, so much more serious anxiety that underlies that seemingly humorous light adventure text that it was interesting. But in terms of negotiating, yeah, how to negotiate your adherence to those ideals of romantic nationalism, the idea that you nostalgia for Ukraine autonomy, at the same time your kind of allegiance to modernity and the project of, you know, modernization that for them was associated with the center in St. Petersburg with the Russian Empire. And I've heard some Ukrainian scholars often dismissing Kulish, not dismissing, but kind of claiming that they saw it as inevitable that Ukraine has to be part of the like Russian Empire. It was the only way at the time, and they didn't question it. And I think exactly by looking at Gothic tropes, you see that the situation is much more ambiguous. And they, at the same time, yes, theoretically, they proclaim that this is the case. And yet the nostalgia is still breaking through with the ruins, with the fragments, with the chalice, that's lost. And that's recovered in Walter Scott's novel. So everything is, you know, all the ends are tied, right? Everything comes to this kind of nice, rational reconciliation. But in Kulish, it's never found. And it's the chalice that belonged to the hetman of Ukraine fighting before it became part of Russia. So I think we have much more ambiguity, much more open-endedness in those Ukrainian works than sometimes given credit for. But thanks. I'm glad you brought up the funny aspects. It was that novel, actually, Mikhail Chernyshenko. Kulish is known in the Ukrainian canon for his later work, Chorna Rada, The Black Council. And it's a classic. It's now studied at school. In my time, Kulish was persona non grata. He was a bourgeois nationalist. We didn't read him in Soviet context. I only discovered him in college. But I'm so glad my colleague actually pointed out this novel to me. And I read the original edition in Kyiv in the library, three volumes. And very few people work on it, and it's fascinating. It's funny. It's rich. It has all these layers of various different ethnic groups, like the Serbs, the Jew, the Ukrainians coming together in a fascinating, complex relationship. So it was a very productive terrain for me.
That's great. I think we are almost out of time, but before we go, what are you working on now?
Yeah, I'm sort of at the crossroads because obviously you finish one big project, right? And I had some articles published on unrelated topics on hysteria, actually, which was very interesting. Also in the connection to empire and how different ethnicities were presented in medical works, actually, not in literary works. That's my only article that doesn't have a single literary text in it, but they read medical articles and essays at the end of the 19th century through kind of this discourse analysis lens and see an interesting desire to kind of justify especially male hysteria and soldiers, right? How Russian healthy Russian soldier can be hysterical. It has to be Jew. It has to be Pole. So there is some interesting material there, but it's just a side project. I had some materials from my previous research. I've been working on race and post-reform Russia and in particular in connection to Chernyshevsky's novel, What is to be Done? And I thought it would be my next project, the larger discussion of race by Russian radical writers and critics. But then the war in Ukraine started and I started feeling like more drawn again to the Ukrainian material. So I'm a bit at the crossroads now deciding what's next. And actually, my husband and colleague who also spoke on your podcast, David Cooper, and I are thinking about translating the content graduate into English, maybe a kind of family / professional project, because it's not known. And it's such an interesting work that could be another important and fun project to do. So it's kind of open-ended right now. I don't have one big project I've committed to, but I'm still figuring it out.
I feel like we're seeing a resurgence of the Gothic right now. Also, I feel like it's very in vogue. So that seems like, yeah, I mean, more than its value on its own. I think that would be great.
I wasn't planning it so pragmatically, but yeah, it's just intrigued me. So.
Dr. Valeria Sobel, thank you so much for joining us. This has been so fascinating. Wow. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks so much. You asked some great questions and it was a pleasure being here. Thank you.
The Slavic Connection is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this program represent the views of the hosts and the guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin. For more information, please visit us online at slavxradio.com. Thank you.
The Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies condemns the Russian Federation's military invasion of Ukraine. We stand in support of the people of Ukraine who are fighting for their lives and sovereignty in the face of the unjustified invasion by Russian military forces.
I have another interview right now. Okay. Don't cry too much. I hope it went okay. Sometimes, you know, hard to give a focused answer, you know, when there's so much in my head from all these different works. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye.
Every time we podcast.